Amplifying the voices of Texas's Black legislators. We'll tell you about a revived effort today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Remember that Texas county with no confirmed coronavirus cases? Yeah, that didn't last. What's going on in Loving County? Plus, how the oil bust has also led to a land value bust, how it's playing out in the Permian Basin. Could we call what's happening in the White House right now a coup? The answer from an expert in authoritarian regimes might surprise you. We'll put it into context. And we'll fact-check a claim about early voting and voter fraud. All that and more, just ahead on the Texas Standard. From El Paso County to Potter County, Lubbock County to, yes, Loving County. The coronavirus now officially confirmed all across Texas and in every county in the contiguous United States. It's the Texas Standard for Wednesday, November 18th. I'm Laura Rice. And that's right, since this time yesterday, the headline in the New York Times changed from suspicion of coronavirus cases in Loving County to the actuality. We'll talk to the reporter about what happened in just a few minutes, but first, preparations for what's sure to be a very important Texas legislative session, not only dealing with the state response to the pandemic and its toll on the economy, but also issues stemming from the renewed reckoning on racism across the country. The Texas Legislative Black Caucus is bringing back its nonprofit foundation. For some understanding on how lawmakers hope this will amplify their efforts, we turn to Caucus President, Houston Democrat Representative Harold Dutton. Representative Dutton, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So what is the Black Caucus Foundation, and how do you hope it will amplify your priorities for the 2021 session?
The Legislative Black Caucus actually was founded in 1985. The Black Caucus right now is a collection of 19 members of the legislature. There are 17 members in the House and two senators we have, and that's kind of all we are. And everybody knows that obviously that's not a majority, so a lot of what we have to do is to convince others to join us in whatever we're doing. We have a situation where we have what's called a front mic and a back mic on the House floor. Mm-hmm. And the front mic is generally the area where a legislator will get up and try to convince the rest of the membership in the House to actually go along with them or to vote with them. Now, one of the things we have recognized in the foundation is that we've not done enough in terms of talking to people before we get on that front mic to talk about the issues and to explain the issues and to research the issues, so that now what we're going to have is a foundation that essentially does all that front mic preparation before we get to the front mic, so that when we do get to the front mic with an issue, there would have been, here's what the problem is, and here's what the solution is to that problem, and we'll hopefully get that to enough people and have enough people on our side that will help us advance those issues, because many of these issues that we're facing right now are not new in terms of issues that the Black Caucus have tried to address. We have done that typically since 1985, or at least since 1973, when this Legislative Black Caucus was created.
Now, two bills already getting attention this session are the Botham Jean Act and the George Floyd Act. What do they propose?
One of the things the caucus and the foundation has recognized is that many people, while the caucus talked about these kinds of issues before, a lot of people weren't interested. And part of their disinterest was caused by the fact that they didn't see what we were talking about. Well, when George Floyd was murdered, in where everybody now could see that happen, at least created a requirement that they do something or say something. In terms of the both issues, what we're trying to do is eliminate the opportunity for the statutes to protect that office, so that we don't have we can at least say we have done something to eliminate the opportunity to have more Botham Johns around and more George Floyds around.
What other measures will your caucus be pushing for this session? There's been a lot of back and forth about, you know, quote unquote, defunding the police. Is that something you're looking into?
Well, not necessarily. Our caucus has taken the position that insofar as defund the police means taking resources away from police, that's not something we have been advocating. We do, however, to the extent that we're requiring police officers to do other things more than policing, we need to take a look at those, because some situations that police are called to do not require policing actions as near as much as they required, for example, a mental health professional.
There was some hope Democrats would gain control of the Texas House. Since that didn't happen, how does that affect your outlook for getting your goals accomplished?
Well, we've always had to sort of get more votes than our 19 members of our caucus. And so our mission hasn't changed. Our objective hadn't changed. And we don't we recognize that sometimes being on the right side means that we will have difficult challenges to face. But we're ready to do that.
We've been speaking with State Representative Harold Dutton. He's a Democrat from Houston and the president of the Texas Legislative Black Caucus. Representative Dutton, thank you again.
Thank you.
Let's make our way now to Loving County in West Texas, as the county with the fewest people living in it in the entire contiguous United States, Loving sometimes attracts national press attention. Just yesterday, we mentioned a New York Times article tracking how Loving County, with a population under 200, was the only place in the entire mainland United States without a reported COVID-19 case. But even the headline to that story cast doubt on that claim, and hours after it was published, confirmation that it was indeed a myth. New York Times reporter J. David Goodman found it all reveals a lot about Loving County and the great divide between its residents and those who come to work there. David, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me.
Most Texans even haven't probably been through Loving County. Can you describe your impressions?
The highways are actually quite busy. So, you know, as you're driving through, it doesn't feel empty unless you stop. And then you really get a sense of these sort of wide open, flat, you know, West Texas oil plains. And that's, you know, quite different from even other parts of Texas. And it has a real distinct feel when you're there.
Your first article on Loving described suspicion of coronavirus in the county. What were you hearing from people, and when did the story change?
Well, the thing that I realized immediately when I got there, you know, the whole notion of going there was that this is a county, the only one in the lower 48 states that really had no reported cases of coronavirus. And so the question is, you know, what's going on there? How is that possible? And immediately upon arriving, I had the impression that it just didn't seem possible that could be true, just given how many people were coming through. And everyone I talked to, you know, from the food vendors to the locals, you know, talked about all the men, and it's mostly men who work in the oil fields there. You're coming from you know, far afield, from other states, from, you know, even other countries, to come and see how the production goes. And in the middle of a pandemic, to be welcoming people from all over, you know, the country and the world, especially at this moment of extreme outbreak, it just didn't seem likely that there was no virus in the county, even though that was sort of the line that many of the county officials said at first. But as I started to talk to them, I you know, I heard about, you know, oh, there was a case actually at one of the man camps, one of the places where the workers stay. And then I talked to one of the workers at the local clinic, and he told me that they had had two positive tests that they had conducted, one over the summer and one more recently. And so I got the impression that this was at best a technical zero that they had there, that there were cases that were coming through, but that they weren't among the 169, you know, people that officially live there, according to the most recent census survey. And then, sure enough, after we wrote the story, a few hours later, the Texas Department of Health on its website reported that there were three cases in the county for the first time. And so, you know, the suspicions that you know, were gleaned from being there were turned out to be true in this case.
So do we know anything about these three cases, whether they're the ones that you highlighted or whether they're active or anything at all?
Yeah, it continues to be a little bit of a mystery. I immediately after that data went up, and so this happened just, you know, they update the data on the website in the evening, and these numbers popped up suddenly. And it was a little bit of a shock. We had to sort of recast the story a little bit to take this into account. And I immediately reached out to some of the county officials that I knew there, and they seemed to be in the dark about it. The clinic hadn't done the test themselves, at least that's what they believed at the time. And the Texas, the officials for the state were sort of looking into this to try and figure out still, even though they reported these three cases, when did these occur and were they, in fact, residents of Loving County? And the way they count this is if you're you test positive somewhere, you know, let's say you test positive in Dallas, but your address is in Plano, they would count you most likely as a Plano positive. In this case, that's why Loving County, even though there's so many people passing through and possibly many people had positive tests in their history, especially even when they're in Loving County, they may have had addresses elsewhere. And so those cases got attributed elsewhere. So the question is, were those accurate addresses? What's the history and when were they? And we don't know that yet.
I wonder, you know, you mentioned testing and relating it to where people live or where they were tested. But I wonder if it also at the root of the story has something to do about access to testing in Loving County. Do you think that's true?
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, there is no hospital in Loving County. There is a clinic, and the clinic, I was told by the locals, does offer free, you know, sort of consultation and services to the locals. And they do have COVID testing there, but there's not the same level of, you know, interest or accessibility for people who are maybe, you know, you have a sore throat and you think you might have had exposure to someone, you go get tested if you live in Houston. But in Loving County, it would be an effort. You'd have to drive probably to Odessa to have that happen, which is like about 90 minutes away from the middle of Loving County. So they weren't doing that as far as I know.
J. David Goodman is a reporter for the New York Times. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. David, thanks again.
Oh, thanks so much.
Checking in now with social media editor Wells Dunbar. Hey, Wells.
Hey, Laura. The conversation around coronavirus continuing to dominate discussion on social media. On our Facebook page, Maddie Burney says the number of COVID cases in her county are getting higher and higher while our schools stay open, with more students being quarantined. That remark coming from Waco. Meanwhile, Llewellyn Avery Forrest says she's trying to comprehend the people who are claiming COVID to be a hoax as they lay dying in the hospital. Obviously, as with the disease not going anywhere, neither are the takes and perspectives about it. Just one of the stories we're watching today, Laura. I'll be back with more later in the program.
Absolutely. And you can let us know what's on your mind, pandemic or otherwise. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, or you can email texasstandard@kut.org. There's more of the show just ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. For decades, American Legion posts across the country have served as community hubs for veterans and their families. But the pandemic has forced many posts to shut their doors. Robert Garova reports for the American Homefront Project and finds how the pandemic is upending finances and culture at the posts.
First of all, thanks for everybody coming out. Give yourselves a round of applause coming out and supporting American Legion Post 397!
That's comedian Scott Shimamoto, coming to you from the parking lot of Monterey Park, California's Post 397. On a recent Saturday night, this post put on a physically distanced outdoor comedy show, complete with a stage, MC.
I helped with getting, you know, the DJ and the taquero here.
John Padilla helped organize this event. He's not a veteran, but he's been coming to this post since his friend, a Vietnam vet, first invited him.
I know it's been difficult for them because they're used to having a big audience here and having their friends that are, you know, veterans. The daily life, their routine has been disrupted.
Gabriel Suarez has been commander of this post for the past decade. It's got about 70 members now. Pre-pandemic, Suarez says this post would host parties almost every weekend. It's the kind of place veterans could grab a drink, enjoy a meal, and swap stories over a game of pool. It's been hard not having community gatherings as often as they used to, Suarez motions to a water feature behind us that's gone dry.
Every veteran would sit right there and just listening to the babbling of the water until they fell asleep. And most of them did with the cigar in their hand. It's just those little things, you know, we provide a home environment.
Tonight's show is about camaraderie, sure, but it's also about keeping the lights on. Billed as a fundraiser event, money generated tonight will go towards helping the Post compensate for the hit it's taken since the pandemic has frozen bar sales, hall rentals, and other sources of income.
We need to keep our building open so that we're able to do the food bank, so we're able to invite our comics out tonight.
Paul Brown is adjutant for the American Legion Department of California.
We have about 423 posts in California, and I'm fairly certain a good 20% of them are in danger of financially having to close their doors.
Brown says what local posts here in California are feeling is probably not too much different from the restaurant industry, especially as they feel the whiplash from state reopening guidance, which has changed over the last several months.
They're trying to adapt, they're trying to modify, they're trying to overcome the situation and survive it.
It's hard to get a sense of just how much the pandemic has affected the more than 12,000 posts across the country, but
we are definitely concerned about it.
Jeff Stouffer is director of media and communications at the Legion's headquarters in Indiana.
A lot of posts have just basically converted what they were doing toward different purposes.
That's meant comedy nights like the one I went to, or a drive-in movie theater at a post in Hollywood. Michael Helmstead is vice commander of Hollywood's Post 43.
We've had to figure out how to modernize a lot of American Legions. The American Legion historically is, you know, not real fast to take to change in new technologies and things like that. So this has kind of forced us to really step up in ways that would have taken us a lot longer.
And that, Helmstead says, may be one silver lining on the cloud of this pandemic. I'm Robert Garova in Los Angeles.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. It wasn't too long ago that some of the state's hottest real estate was in the Permian oil fields. Now those once pricey land parcels have seen a huge dip thanks to the pandemic oil bust. It's a trend that Houston Chronicle business reporter Paul Takahashi has written about. Paul, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So give us an idea of the scope of this downturn. What's going on with land prices?
So land prices have fallen precipitously over the past 2 years. There was a report that came out this week from Rystad, which is a Norwegian energy research firm, that found that the average price of a shale acreage across the country has fallen by more than 70% in just 2 years. Right now, it's about $5,000 per acre. And that's down from $17,000 an acre in 2018. So we've seen a big drop in land prices across the country in these shale oil plays. And that's primarily due to the fact that oil and gas companies are not drilling many new wells to pump for oil and gas right now because of the pandemic. A lot of folks are still working from home and are not traveling as much. And so the demand is just simply not there.
But we know that the oil market operates in booms and busts. So is this real estate downturn a new phenomenon, or is this something that we've seen before?
It's something that we've seen before. This is a cyclical industry, albeit a very volatile commodity market. And so, you know, the price of oil goes up and down. I will have to say the impact this time around has been really unprecedented. In previous oil busts, say in 2014, it was primarily due to an economic recession. You had a slowdown in maybe factory output, or just a slowdown in general of businesses. In this case, we really had a full-on stop for a period of several months, and you've had fits and starts of state economies and local economies around the country. And oil and gas is no different. You know, they stopped production of existing wells and drilling of new wells for a period of several months this spring because of the pandemic.
Now, some energy industry experts are saying we've hit peak oil demand and fossil fuels are entering a slow decline. Do you think that prices will ever rebound to where they were?
I think a lot of experts that I've talked to in the industry, they don't see oil prices rebounding to over $100 a barrel anytime soon. We see, of course, a shift in perceptions and societal concerns, of course, growing about climate change. And that's really pushed governments and companies and consumers to really think hard about our dependence on fossil fuels. Especially in Europe, you're seeing a big shift away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, and companies from the tech sector to even oil and gas companies now, such as BP, they have set net zero carbon emissions targets to really lower the use of oil and gas. And so I think there is going to be a period of time where the pandemic right now is depressing demand and therefore prices. But in the future, you know, once we come out of this pandemic, demand may be declining just as a result of concerns about climate change. And, you know, the consumers are also moving towards electric vehicles. And so that's all going to contribute to keeping prices down. And so, you know, there are, of course, contrary projections and folks who are more bullish on oil prices. But there is a sense in the industry from listening on earnings calls and talking to CEOs that they are preparing for a period of time in which oil prices will be lower for longer.
Paul Takahashi is a business reporter for the Houston Chronicle. We'll have a link to his reporting at texasstandard.org. Paul, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network that has been caring for Texans for more than 30 years. More than 55 physicians in the Austin area treat 26,000 cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Hospitals across the state are nearing capacity as coronavirus cases continue to spike. That includes Midland Memorial Hospital in West Texas. Its CEO, Russell Myers, told the Midland City Council on Tuesday that they're running out of beds and the hospital staff is stretched thin. He said 111 employees are currently quarantined.
68 of those have tested positive and the other 43 have suspicious symptoms and are likely to test positive given enough time for incubation. We have another 120 who've been exposed and are monitoring. So about 10% of our workforce has been exposed to COVID.
Myers added the state of Texas and the federal government have provided additional staff to assist the hospital. Harris County's public health director is stepping down from his role next month. Dr. Umair Shah will become the next Secretary of Health for the state of Washington. His departure comes as Harris County continues to have the most COVID-19 cases of any county in Texas. Still, Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo says Shah will still be around to aid in the transition, with the goal of maintaining consistency for residents.
Residents should know that services will continue uninterrupted. We're going to continue making sure that Harris County Public Health has the resources it needs to be supported. And we're all grateful to Dr. Shah for his work in our county and to his team.
Shah's last day is December 18th. New research finds race and gender play a role in whether white people think someone has the right to own a gun. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has more on why some people's beliefs about the Second Amendment may waver.
The Rice University study asked white Republicans and Democrats about who has the right to own a firearm. White Republicans were more likely to be supportive of gun ownership overall, except if the person with a gun is a black man. White Democrats had a different reaction, says Rice researcher Matthew Hayes.
What we find is more of a gender effect, where Democrats are more supportive of black women and white women owning guns than they are of men of either race, and they're most supportive of white women owning guns.
Hayes says the research is a reminder to policymakers that their constituents may support certain policies because of who they affect, not the policies themselves. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
Federal law enforcement is investigating Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. The Associated Press reports the FBI is looking into allegations made by former aides that Paxton committed crimes to benefit a political donor. They accuse him of bribery and abuse of office. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from HipCamp, an online resource for booking camping, glamping, and RV stays in the U.S., connecting nature lovers with landowners. Learn more about hosting at hipcamp.com/land.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. As the nation gears up for the Electoral College's official vote in December, many words have been used to describe President Trump's reaction to his loss. One word we're exploring today has sort of a nice mouthfeel to it, but a very serious meaning. I'm talking about coup. It's something Latin American countries have experienced in recent history, but does it at all describe what we're experiencing here in the U.S.? For more, we turn to Professor Kenneth Green. He's an associate professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin, whose research focuses on authoritarian regimes and democratization. Professor, thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure thing.
Before we get very far into this, can you explain what a coup is and give us just a bit of history?
Yeah, so the word coup d'etat, comes from the French, and it means blow against the state, more or less. It's usually thought of as sort of a sudden, decisive, usually illegal change of government, and it typically involves overthrowing, removing, and replacing the sitting government with a new one.
So in my non-expert view, coups have often been associated with a military takeover. I've heard military coup. Is that even a remote possibility here in the U.S. with what we've heard from American military leaders?
So we usually think about two types of coups. One is definitely a military coup, and the other is a self-coup, where a sitting leader will act against political opponents that are in power, typically in Congress, and try to shut down Congress in order to concentrate or consolidate power. In the U.S., a military coup seems extremely far-fetched to me. I do find it really notable that General Mark Milley felt compelled to remind the troops that the military in the U.S. is loyal to the Constitution and not to an individual leader. I find that quite scary to hear, but I do think that that he's correct and that the military would not go along with a power grab.
So in your point of view, does the weight of the word coup at all describe what you're seeing play out in the White House's response to election results?
Well, I want to say two things about this. The first is that if we saw the current actions happening in another country around the world, many people in the U.S. would be calling it a coup in process. We have a few very concerning elements. We have a refusal to concede, even though we recognize that the timeline doesn't require it and that we haven't had the results certified in each of the states. But we do have a sitting president casting doubt on the legitimacy of voting, which is obviously the bedrock core element of democracy. We have an attorney general who is investigating seemingly unfounded claims of fraud. We have the intimidation of local electoral authorities. There's this sort of hanging idea of telling thugs to stand by. And then recent purges, the Secretary of Defense, possibly others coming. And we have loose talk of state legislators discarding election results to choose pro-Trump electors. All of those things would, I think, be so concerning for people in the U.S. were it to occur in another country that we would be calling it a coup in process. Nevertheless, I don't think it describes what's going on here. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. It could be coup planning. But I think it's more likely the result of a leader who finds himself cornered and wanting to figure out a way that he can simultaneously mobilize his base and ensure his political future.
Is there anything we can learn from other countries as we move towards new leadership, especially as, you know, many regular people and elected officials are still claiming without evidence mass voter fraud?
Well, the major lesson from other countries is not to sit idly by, that you need to take these kinds of things seriously. Threats to democracy, when they're genuine, serious threats to democracy, need to be responded to. And I think the response needs to be organization at this point among pro-democracy actors. I think there needs to be pressure put on legislators from both parties to ensure that the vote counts are recognized and considered legitimate. I also think that the media companies need to take a leading role in ensuring that they remind citizens about the electoral system, how it functions, and the extreme difficulty of perpetrating outcome-changing fraud in the U.S.
Kenneth Green is an associate professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Green, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. The coronavirus pandemic's effects are far-reaching. It's hurt everyone in some way, whether it's the loss of a loved one, the loss of income, or the isolation we're all facing. A Fort Worth couple is feeling the pain on all of these fronts. KERA's Miranda Suarez has their story.
No one's working on any cars at Ponce's Transmissions in Fort Worth. The owner, Joe Ponce Jr., says it wasn't always this quiet.
Sometimes you can have cars raised up, another car underneath or over there. I mean, you could put...
Business dried up after people stopped receiving their extra $600 in unemployment benefits, included in a COVID relief package.
And sure enough, about 2 weeks later, it's been like this, and it's just, it's gotten from worse to worse.
The same relief funds also offered paycheck protection loans to help businesses keep their employees. But it didn't last, and he had to let go of most of his staff, including his wife, Arlene.
There was five of us, and now it's just two of us.
All that's left is him and a coworker who's been with Joe since the beginning. Joe started the business in 1979. Their son, Joe Ponce III, who his parents called Jojo, grew up at the shop's original location on the north side of Fort Worth. Arlene remembers her baby coming home covered in grease after a day at the shop.
And they left a black grease ring around the top. That's why I said, you're not taking him back over there no more. You're not watching him. He's all over the place.
Jojo still spent a lot of time there. He learned how to build a transmission when he was still a kid. As an adult, he was the shop's office manager. His father planned to pass the business on to him. But this past spring, Jojo got sick.
He didn't die of COVID, but I believe he died because of it. I believe he was collateral damage.
Joe Ponce says his son had a stomach ache that turned out to be a hernia blocking his intestine. He was in the hospital for weeks. Jojo died suddenly on April 17th. His parents say COVID-19 restrictions prevented them from visiting him in the hospital.
But we called every day, and we asked them if we can go and see him. They said no. And you know when they called us to go down there? When he was already gone.
Texas Health Harris Methodist, the hospital where Jojo died, confirmed that its COVID policy at that time did not allow most inpatients to have visitors. They made exceptions for patients nearing the end of life. Joe and Arlene think things could have turned out differently if they were just allowed to see their son. And as they grapple with his loss, they have to deal with everything else going on in the world. Arlene has health conditions that put her at a higher risk for a severe case of COVID. And right now, Joe and Arlene's granddaughter is living with them, along with her boyfriend and baby twin boys.
It's just going to take one person to get sick. And there we all are.
Life is just hard for the family right now.
Can you imagine if they had to go out on their own? People cannot pay rent. People cannot pay rent, a car payment, car insurance, utilities, bills. How are you going to do it? I don't get it.
Joe and Arlene are not fans of President Donald Trump. They're hoping a Biden White House would treat the pandemic more seriously and provide more financial aid for families who need it. Arlene is scared. She just wants to see an end to the pandemic and the political chaos.
After these elections, I'm kind of excited to see what's going to happen, you know, for the better, I hope.
As for their financial situation, Joe and Arlene say they'll be okay. They already own their shop and their house.
I don't really care about getting a whole lot of work. I'm just one of those that's happy just to make a living. And it was something that I had hoped to leave for my son.
The Ponces remember their son Jojo for his larger-than-life presence. He was loud and had a sarcastic sense of humor.
One time I told him at the house, I said, you know what, Jojo, not everybody has a sense of humor. he goes, I know.
Because of the pandemic, the Ponces had to wait 6 months after Jojo's death to have an in-person memorial service. They almost canceled it for fear of spreading COVID, but it turned out well. About 50 people came and they shared videos, pictures, music, and catered barbecue. Jojo's friends and cousins were also able to come. Arlene says her son probably would have loved to be there. I'm Miranda Suarez in Fort Worth.
Many of us are modifying our holiday plans this year to limit the possible spread of COVID-19. As a result, many of us are sure to miss the comforts of tradition. That includes the people, of course, friends and family, and the food. Texas Standard commentator W.F. Strong recalls when he was in a somewhat limiting circumstance and pining for an iconic Texas meal.
Many years ago, I took a job in Africa for the period of a year. While there, I just couldn't find much to eat that I liked. I lost about 20, 25 pounds in 6 months. I was so thin, the local care guys joked that they might have to send me a package. It was at this point of mild starvation that a friend of mine back in Texas, Don Love, sent me a 2x3-foot poster of a Whataburger, 10 times life-size, hot cheese, mustard, and onions cascading seductively down the sides. I think it was the cruelest thing my former friend could have done. There I was in Whataburgerless Africa, staring at that poster every day. He had me Whataburger dreaming for months. After a year in the African hinterland, I flew back into DFW. Though it was midnight, I hailed a taxi and I said, take me to the nearest Whataburger. I got a double meat, double cheese with chopped jalapenos. I wada-sized the fries and the Coke and chased it all with a chocolate shake and an apple pie. I'm not alone in having these priorities. Soldiers on leave from posts around the world often go straight to Whataburger when they get home. I tell you, if the Pentagon would make MRE Whataburgers, it would lift morale. Some people who live in Whataburgerless states will drive a couple of days to get a Whataburger. They don't even check into a hotel. They just eat one, take one to go, and drive back home. So you see, there are only two kinds of states in America, those who have Whataburgers and those who wish they did. In the Whataburger states, there are connoisseurs who feel that there is a particular restaurant that makes the best Whataburger of all. They will drive 60, 70 miles in this holy grail-type quest to get what they feel is the Whataburger of Whataburgers. Whataburger is a Texan chain born as a food stand on Air Street in Corpus Christi back in 1950. It was the brainchild of a burger visionary named Harmon Dobson. Dobson's goal was unique. In a time of small burgers, he wanted to make one so big it would take two hands to hold it, and so good that with one bite people would say, what a burger. And it was so. When my mom used to take me and my two brothers to Whataburger when we were just little boys, she would spread newspapers across our laps in the back seat of the cavernous old Buick sedan. Then she would cut the burgers in half and serve them to us that way, one half at a time, so we wouldn't make a mess of her protective plastic seat covers. Three things I loved about the early Whataburgers. One, the triangular buildings that looked like the orange table tents everybody takes as souvenirs today. The smell of burgers and onions that permeated the air within half a block. And my mother saying, if you finish all that, you can have a shake. Today, there are 810 Whataburgers across the orange states of Whataburger Nation, from Arizona to Florida. Texas remains the capital, of course. And all of these Whataburgers are open 24/7, proving every day that everything is bigger and better in Texas. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
Since we first aired this commentary, there are even more Whataburgers, 842 U.S. locations. W.F. Strong is a professor of culture and communication at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley. You can find his stories from Texas at texasstandard.org, in Texas Co-op magazine, and wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's Island Time with safety in mind.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Texas Republican Party Chair Alan West said early voting can lead to voter fraud. So we ask, is that a fact? Joining me now is Brandon Mulder with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Brandon, always good to talk with you.
Happy to be here.
So Texas GOP Chair Alan West said this when and where exactly?
That's right. So Alan West went on a North Texas talk radio show a day after Election Day, and he aired his concerns about voter fraud in the presidential election. Now, as we know, many Republicans in Texas and across the nation have spent the last few weeks casting doubts over the integrity of mail-in ballots and Joe Biden's success with them. But West goes on to say that it's not just vote by mail that introduces fraud. He claims that early voting also exposes the process to fraud. And on the radio, he suggests eliminating early voting altogether.
All right, let's listen to this tape.
Democrats, Independents, Green Party, they should join with us in making sure that we have a Loctite solid process. And you're right, early voting, we don't need to have this early voting. That the election day should be a national holiday. But when you hear people talking about we can extend 2 days, 7 days, 2 weeks after election day, it just opens it up for this chicanery and this fraud that we're seeing.
So it's not the first time, I understand, West has targeted early voting. He recently sued Governor Greg Abbott over his extension of the early voting period amid the pandemic. Is that right?
That's right. And that was back in September when he joined a handful of other state Republicans in a lawsuit that sought to block the governor's decision to extend the early voting period by 6 days. That lawsuit was later rejected by the state Supreme Court. But in it, they argued that moving the start date of the early voting period defied state law. There's no mention of early voting exposing the election process to fraud, as West is now claiming.
So what kind of evidence is out there showing the prevalence of fraud actually tied to early voting?
So we looked at the Election Fraud Database, which is maintained by the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank up in Washington, D.C. In the last 38 years, the foundation has recorded about 1,300 cases of voter fraud across the country. So one of the most common ways people committed fraud in these last 38 years was by exploiting the vote-by-mail option. And experts will tell you that the minuscule level of voter fraud that has been documented, more are associated with absentee voting than with early in-person voting. In the Heritage Foundation's database, only about 1% of voter fraud cases that led to a conviction were directly tied to early in-person voting.
Interesting. Now, we've also heard Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick push the voter fraud narrative in recent weeks, although, of course, Governor Abbott was the one who extended the early voting period. But let's talk overall. Would it be correct to say that fraud has had an impact here in Texas when it comes to voting?
Well, there certainly have been cases. The Texas Attorney General's office currently has 75 active investigations into fraud, although they wouldn't tell us how many of those were tied to the 2020 election or how many were associated with early voting, as per Alan West's claim. So while there are certainly documented cases of fraud in Texas and across the country, nearly all of them deal with tens of ballots. So far, there's no evidence showing that it's widespread.
So do we have a ruling on this one?
We do. We rated this false. Of the few voter fraud cases that have been documented, only a sliver of them are associated with early in-person voting.
False. Texas GOP Chair Alan West's claim that early voting opens the door to fraud. That ruling from Brandon Mulder and PolitiFact Texas. Brandon, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Time again to check in with social media editor Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are you hearing out there?
Hey, Laura. Well, lots of talk from our friends and listeners about that topic we heard earlier. Just what exactly is President Donald Trump getting up to with all these repeated challenges to the election, claims without any evidence whatsoever that he won, et cetera, just really casting doubt upon the electoral process. Is this a coup? Would this be called a coup anywhere else? And folks having some interesting reactions to that via our Facebook page. Cindy Berry says his actions prove how little he cares about national security and Americans' welfare. He's creating a playbook for future election rigging and chaos. Very dangerous. John Davis says, of course, it's a scandal and says it's undermining credibility of our nation, our democracy and his office. He says what makes it an even bigger scandal are the cowards and enablers that allow this to happen and in some cases join in on the farce. An interesting perspective here again from Joshua Boston. He says, no matter who wins, faith in the electoral process is done. Half the country swore Russia changed our 2016 election, and now another half is certain that there was widespread fraud this election and that they're being effectively shut out of the voting process. So interesting comparison there between the 2016 and 2020 elections. However, I think it's fair to say that we didn't see this concerted push from top party leaders on that other one, not to the extent that President Trump has been here in challenging the election results. And it's just fascinating to see it unfold on Twitter. I don't know about you, but I'm getting really sick of seeing that disclaimer that says official sources called this election differently. Yeah, it's like every single tweet he puts up, it's just peppered with these disclaimers basically saying this is fake. This is not real. This is made up.
Right.
So it's odd, and it's the sort of thing that you have to wonder about. Is this really getting lost in the sort of churn of other news? Maybe just people sort of tuning out from this election season and the fatigue there. So it's a heck of a story we're in, Laura, and I don't really know if people are appreciating just how heck of a big story it really is.
Right. Well, and I was getting to that point. Coup is sort of it's a fun word to say. It's fun to throw around, but it's a real serious issue, and it's not something to be taken lightly. So this expert that we talked to, trying to remove it from the political spectacle and just take a sober look at it, it's something to think about if this were happening somewhere else, and to evaluate it that way, I think is an interesting way to look at it, trying to, again, remove the politics and how any particular person feels about this particular president. It's sobering is the word I keep coming back to.
Yeah. It's really shocking to think just about, where we were at the beginning of this year and where we are now. And of course, the COVID-19 surge is a huge, huge part of that. I'm just looking at scanning the headlines here. I see this one from our media partners at the Texas Tribune. Coronavirus cases in Texas are soaring again, but this time Governor Greg Abbott says no lockdown is coming. And of course, this is something we talked about in the Texas Standard newsletter this week, Laura, about with the impending holiday season here, travel, lots of concern about what that's going to look like and what that is going to do to the number of cases we're seeing here in Texas already.
Yep, hard conversations happening with family and friends this year. All right, thank you so much for joining us. We will see you back here tomorrow, and you can always find more online, texasstandard.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.